It's time for America Outdoors Radio, the show that covers the outdoor scene across the U.S. of A. and the entire continent. Fishing, hunting, conservation, outdoor recreation, and great destinations, we cover it all every week. It's your country, your outdoors. Let's explore it together with your host, John Cruz.
As you know, we love sharing record fish stories on this show, and while many of the anglers who catch these monster fish are very, very good when it comes to fishing, there's also an element of luck involved. When it comes to lucky anglers and record fish, I do believe Jeffrey Sanford from South Burlington, Vermont, may be one of the luckiest I've ever heard of. Jeffrey was fishing out on Lake Champlain this summer, and he had bought his first boat this year, was actually in it for the first time. He was also alone. Now, on his first cast, yes, his very first cast, he dropped a jig down some 100 feet and it was inhaled by a 36 and a half inch lake trout. Jeffrey reeled it in, netted it by himself, and had that fish weighed, it ended up weighing 19.36 pounds at the Lake Champlain's International's Basin Derby, where it's the first place fish in the lake trout category. But wait, there's more. Sanford's Laker is not only the big trout of the local derby, but also the biggest lake trout ever caught out of Lake Champlain in Vermont since they started keeping records for those fish in 1969. Now that is lucky. Another angler who admitted having some luck, but who also puts in the time on the water, is Robert Ferraro. According to Go Erie, this Pennsylvania angler was out on Lake Erie fishing on August 8th. We've told you what a great walleye fishery Lake Erie is, and Ferraro loves to target them. But on this August day, a 20-pound, 9-ounce brown trout measuring over 33 inches smashed the hook at the end of his line. Ferraro battled this brown bruiser and got him into his boat, after which he got it weighed on a certified scale, and this trout, which will soon be mounted on a wall in Ferraro's home, has been certified as a Pennsylvania state record. Heading out west, we can report an Idaho state record cutthroat trout was caught and released out of the Snake River for the second time this year. It's not the same fish, oh no. The last one was a 30-incher. This one is a 31-inch cutthroat, and while it was only an inch longer than the record fish caught out of this river in eastern Idaho earlier this summer, this one's got a lot more girth to it. The angler who caught it? That would be Nate Burr from Rexburg, Idaho, and in this case, skill may have had more to do with it than luck. You see, Nate is a fly fishing guide, and he had been hunting for monster trout on this section of the Snake River for 3 straight days before this huge cutthroat smashed his fly. We've got a saltwater record fish to tell you about as well. The fish in question, a trigger fish. It was caught by Logan Liddick from Carlisle, PA, off the coast of Ocean City, Maryland last month. Liddick was fishing for sea bass using clam for bait when the fish struck and took off. Liddick got that fish in, and it ended up measuring 20 inches and weighing 6 pounds, beating a 5.6 pound Maryland state record established last year in the same area. Sounds to me like Ocean City, Maryland is the place to be if you're after a big trigger fish. Congratulations are definitely in order for Logan, Nate, Robert, and Jeffrey for reeling in the fish of a lifetime. I am impressed. This week on America Outdoors Radio, we've got a whole bunch of fishing, hunting, and yes, even some adventure travel on tap for you. We're going to start things off in just a minute in the state of Missouri, where hand fishing, also known as noodling, for catfish is illegal, and we'll explain why. After that, we'll head north to Minnesota. That's the state guide and author Kip Veith calls home. Kip is a rare breed. He's not only a muskie fishing guide, but on top of that, a fly fishing guide for muskie, and he just wrote The Orvis Guide to Muskies on the Fly. Kip's going to share some tips with you about how to catch muskies this fall, no matter where you live in the United States, and how you just might hook into the fish of 10,000 casts using a fly rod. Our next stop after that is Utah. That's where John Snow, the shooting editor for Outdoor Life magazine, just went on a guided public land moose hunt. He's going to tell you the story of how it went down, and I'll tell you in advance, it's a very, very different sort of hunting story, to say the least. Want a little bit more of a preview? Well, you've heard of long courtships and you've heard of speed dating, right? I think many of us approach big game hunts on public land as a long courtship, spending several days in the field looking to bag the right animal. This hunt? Definitely the speed dating version of that. We'll make it a point to ask John his thoughts about this hunt and if he has any regrets about how this unfolded. As for our final stop of the day, that would be out on the Pacific Ocean where Captain Mac McQuarrie is taking his boat from Alaska to his home port in Washington for the winter, wrapping up a very difficult season at Sportsman's Cove Lodge on Prince of Wales Island in southeast Alaska. How tough of a season was it? Let's just say Murphy's Law was definitely in effect in just about everything that could go wrong did go wrong during this COVID-19 season. On the bright side, though, Sportsman's Cove Lodge is ready to go for 2021. And if you want to socially isolate yourself with your family or friends and still enjoy an awesome Alaska wilderness experience, they have got just the thing for you. It is a spectacular trip. You're going to hear more about it from Captain Mac towards the end of our program. Before we take you to Alaska, Utah, and Minnesota, though, it's time to ring up a certain someone in the Show Me State. Our first guest today on America Outdoors Radio is Corporal Tyler Brown. He works for the Missouri Department of Conservation as an enforcement officer. And our topic today is noodling. This is the method of reaching underwater into natural cavities formed in riverbanks or by tree roots, logs, or rocks, and capturing a catfish by hand. You've all seen this on TV and YouTube videos before. You see, the catfish will actually bite onto the hand, and the noodler or angler pulls the fish off the nest and out of the water. It's primarily used to catch flathead catfish and blue catfish when these fish are spawning and nesting in small rivers and streams. Tyler, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Tyler, noodling is actually legal in several states, but it's illegal in Missouri. Why is that?
Well, we found that the catfish population is especially susceptible when those fish are on the nest. You know, they're on the nest guarding those eggs, protecting them from predators. So we feel that if we allow folks to reach in there underwater and remove those fish from the nest, that it's going to have an impact on the future population of those species.
So when it comes to people who engage in noodling, are most of them keeping the fish or are they doing catch and release?
Generally what we see is they're keeping the fish, and that's why we're concerned about the future population. A lot of times those fish won't come off of the nest unless there's a predator nearby. So stating that, well, you could catch them on a pulled line during that time of year, that's possible, but we're increasing the likelihood of losing those eggs by pulling those fish off the nest.
Gotcha. Now, your agency, the Missouri Department of Conservation, recently stated that if this practice was legal, they estimated 13,000 anglers would participate in this. And despite the fact it's illegal, an estimated 2,000 people still do it anyway. So I'm guessing you see a lot of this, don't you?
Yes, we do.
And not only that, I understand you had a recent case involving some noodlers, so to speak. Why don't you tell our listeners about it?
Yeah, so we were contacted earlier this summer on Lake of the Ozarks by some folks who have witnessed some noodling activity near where they were staying for vacation. So they were able to get us some good quality pictures and video, boat registrations, descriptions. There was four or five conservation agents that put in quite a bit of time to track these folks down. Took some investigative work because registrations were expired and things like that. And just had to do a lot of legwork. And I was actually able to contact the main suspect just on routine patrol one day, find him committing another violation in one of our clear water streams in the area, and he had decided to go four-wheeling in the river.
Oh, geez.
With his big truck. So he had gotten stuck, and I happened to come across him, and we had to sort out a few different issues there. But we were able to put it all together with the help of the citizens calling and letting us know about the violations.
So, give or take, this group of five people who were engaging in this noodling, any idea just how many catfish these five caught by hand and kept?
We don't know. They had caught two that day, and kept them. But we were able to determine that, you know, this is not just a one-time thing. These folks will do this throughout the nesting months, typically June and July, partially into August also, but they don't go just one time, you know, so they're keeping fish every time they're going out.
Right.
And one particular individual, I asked him why he did it, and he said it's just a natural high that you just can't explain.
I get it. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. Again, folks, noodling, it is legal in some states, but as you just heard, you might not want to do it, and you can't do it in Missouri. And the reason why, it's all about conservation. It's all about making sure that we have healthy populations of catfish in our rivers in the South and in the Midwest, and that might just be why catfishing is so darn good in the Show Me State. Tyler, be safe out there, and thanks for sharing this with us today on America Outdoors Radio.
Thank you very much.
Immerse yourself in a complete Alaska wilderness experience through Sportsman's Cove Lodge. Up to six of you will spend a week in a beautiful waterfront log home in a secluded cove. Every day is a new adventure. Go on a guided fishing trip or haul in a bounty of shrimp and crab. Visit a Native American village where totem poles are carved. Go on a whale or bear watching trip and return back to your very own place at the end of the day. Find out more about the Alaska Wilderness Experience at alaskasbestlodge.com. That's alaskasbestlodge.com.
The Dalles in Oregon is your base camp for fishing fun. Reel in big salmon, tangle with steelhead, bass, and walleye, or wrestle a monster sturgeon to the boat. After the day is done, you'll find a variety of lodging options around town. Need to resupply? We've got you covered with sporting goods stores plus great dining, breweries, wineries, and can't-miss attractions like the Gorge Discovery Center. Plan your fishing getaway today at explorethedalles.com. That's explorethedalles.com.
With the Nevin Rudin motor and Minn Kota troller in the Low Ranch fish finder or two, we push off the dock just before 5 o'clock and go sailing off into the blue.
You're back in with America Outdoors Radio. I'm John Cruz. Let's talk about muskie fishing. Muskies, as you know, are called the fish of 10,000 casts. They're one of the toughest fish to get on the end of your line. And once you get them there, you are in for a fight. They are also known as some of the hardest fighting game fish in North America. So I was very interested when I got a book, The Orvis Guide to Muskies on the Fly, because fly fishing for muskie? Let's make it even more difficult. With us here to tell you more about this concept, Kip Veith, the author. Kip, great to have you on the air.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So, Kip, I've got to tell you, when I got the review copy of The Orvis Guide to Muskies on the Fly, I was expecting to open this up and see a whole bunch of patterns and how to tie flies for muskie. I was pleasantly surprised to see that this is actually an in-depth guide on how to catch muskies using a fly rod. Is it as tough as I'm making it out to be, or is this something you'd have a lot of success with?
That's a pretty good question. It's tough. When people ask about it, I relate it to blind casting for permit. If someone's a permit fisherman, they kind of know how hard that is, and then you know, double down on just blind casting for a permit. So it can be very hard, but I've had clients that get a fish the first time they're out. So it's muskie are very, very fickle fish. They're either going to eat it or they're not. There's no in between. They'll follow maybe, but the real deal is trying to get them to eat. And when they want to eat something, they're going to eat it. Doesn't matter what it is.
Well, let's talk a little bit about fly fishing for them and fishing for them in the fall, too. First off, the flies themselves. I've always imagined that your typical musky fly was going to be this big, long, gaudy thing with lots of feathers or maybe a rabbit hair streamer. And I'm guessing there are some like that. But looking in your book, you've got what looks to be like almost bass poppers that are topwater baits, too.
Yeah, they're just an oversized bass popper, pretty much. That's more in the summertime. In the fall, this time of year, seldom would use a topwater presentation unless it's been warm for like 4 or 5 days and you just have your mindset that you want to move a fish on topwater. This week, actually, it's really warm here in Minnesota, so it'd probably be a pretty good time to give it one more shot before it's done for the year. So the summer is the prime popper time, you know, July, August, that time frame, early September, mid-September. And then once that water starts to
cool down, metabolism start to slow down also. So now then it goes into more of a streamer type fishing. And topwater can be very difficult because a muskie is a, like an alligator. Once they clamp on something, they're not going to let it go. And those foam heads or, you know, big hair body divers are sometimes hard to get a hook into the fish. So it's very, very cool when they eat one, but it's, you know, now you're doubling down on the double down from musky fly fishing, I guess.
Oh, my goodness. You're making this out to make the fish of 10,000 casts, 20,000 casts while you're talking till you get one in the boat. But let's talk a little bit about fall fishing. You know, you've been doing this a long time. What's one tip you would give for anglers that would work for anywhere from Minnesota to the Northwest to Tennessee and other states that have muskies, something they should do differently than they're doing in the summer?
Slow it down, I guess. And most of the really good muskie guides out there, there's a ton of good ones here in the upper Midwest. We're really blessed to have some really talented folks. But it's the movement after the movement. So I love my flies to kind of walk the dog underneath the water. And I think people have a tendency to think that a muskie is, you know, just this big barracuda that's just going to come out and hammer something that's burnt. But
right,
actually, as the water gets colder, the metabolism slows down, and they want that big side-to-side, slow action. And also on the figure eight, I've seen a lot of videos of guys just burning figure eights, and they look like they're beating eggs. It's, you know, the slower, it's the, you know, the change of direction and the change of depth that really seem to trigger a muskie next to the boat in the fall.
You know, I've always heard about that figure eight technique where a muskie will follow your lure or your fly to the boat. And if they don't strike, you try doing that figure eight next to the boat. I get how that's pretty easy to do with typical hardware and, you know, spinning and bait casting gear. That's got to be a little difficult with a fly rod, isn't it?
It is. It can be. That's why we use really short leaders, maybe 3 feet at the longest, just so you can manipulate the fly next to the boat. And you don't want to stall it. You want to keep it moving. So, you know, when you're doing a really good figure eight, your fly rod's about halfway into the water, and you're just stirring the pot, you know, just doing an eight or a circle or anything, just trying to change direction and change depth at the same time. So that's kind of the trick to it. It's hard, and that's kind of why I like the fall the best, because there's less of that. They usually eat it a little bit more aggressively. They're trying to put on weight to keep their eggs forming through the winter, so they're kind of putting the fall feed bag on so they can produce those eggs all winter long, and then when the spawn comes, they're ready to go. So bigger fish are all the females, so that's kind of the ones we target anyway. So
another question, the leader, again, you know, your typical guy who's fishing with a bait casting reel or spinning rod, they might even use steel leader because they're such toothy fish. Guessing you're not using steel leader if you're fishing a fly or a streamer.
Yeah, I am. I use 45-pound wire with about a 50-pound mono behind that. So I'll just Albright the wire onto the 50-pound mono, put a perfection loop in the mono, and then I use it for guiding. I use a Stay-Lock snap. It has to be a Stay-Lock snap. There's no other snap to use because I've had every other one of them fail. And then I just do a clinch knot, like a 3 or 4 turn clinch knot onto that Stay-Lock snap, and that's your leader. It's pretty simple stuff. But, you know, I use SA or Rio wire. It's all knottable. It works really well. And some guys don't use that. They use like 80 or 100-pound fluorocarbon, and that's fine. But I'm here to tell you, it's not a matter if, it's a matter when a big fish is going to cut through that fluorocarbon, even that thick a hair, because it's happened to me, and I've never used fluorocarbon after losing a couple big fish one fall. So I'm a wire guy through and through.
I get it. I completely get it. Folks, again, you're listening to America Outdoors Radio. We're talking to Kip Feith. He's the author of The Orvis Guide to Muskies on the Fly, a brand new book that you can get at Amazon.com, bookstores, and other places, too. Let's turn to your guide service, Wildwood Float Trips, located in Minnesota. You offer fall fly fishing trips for muskies and smallmouth bass, don't you?
Yeah, we do. Little smallmouth early in the fall, and like now is kind of the transition time. They pretty much are dropping back, and they're getting into their winter positions, so they're a little tougher to take with the fly rod. And this next week is probably going to be all the start of musky season, probably, you know, mid-October to ice, which is usually first or second week in November is when we're really hardcore musky fishing. So we're blessed here, and I live in Monticello, Minnesota, right on the banks of the upper Mississippi, so I'm pretty blessed. But we have a couple power plants that keep it open. So our smallmouth season runs a little longer than the people that are a little farther up north. They're on different bodies of water.
Well, you are in a true niche fishery in terms of what you do, which means you're probably in quite a bit of demand. Do you actually have openings this fall if folks want to book a fly fishing trip for muskie with you?
We've got a couple real late, not too many, and then I have two other guides that work for me that are very, very good. So we've got some availability, but it does get, you know, it's really a pretty short window. I don't really musky guide much in the summer. I concentrate on smallmouth just because they're a lot of fun.
Yes, they are. So, you have no argument from me there. Smallmouth are a lot of fun.
Muskies are hard enough in the fall, and they're even a little more fickle in the summer because they seem to follow and don't act as nice in the summer as they do in the fall. So
that's kind of why
I break up my season.
Well, folks, if you want to get a head start on learning how to catch muskies on the fly, The Orvis Guide to Muskies on the Fly is the book for you. The author is Kip Vieth, V-I-E-T-H. Look for it online at Amazon. Look for it at bookstores, and you can find it at your website too, wildwoodfloattrips.com. Is that also the place where people can book a trip with you?
They certainly can, yep. Shoot me an email or give me a call, and we'd love to get you out on the water.
That's wildwoodfloattrips.com to book a musky fly fishing trip or maybe a smallmouth bass trip next year, and to order probably an autographed copy of The Orvis Guide to Muskies on the Fly. Kip, thanks for sharing this with us today on America Outdoors Radio.
Thank you. I really appreciate your time.
Bed-making figure eights with musky spinners and lures. Oh, honey, I love you, and that's not a lie. Musky guides all tell the truth. This must be the reason why I miss fishing more than I miss you.
Backcountry Hunters and Anglers seeks to ensure North America's outdoor heritage of hunting and fishing. Lend your voice to the fight by visiting backcountryhunters.org and join the 25,000 men and women who have pledged to defend wildlife and public access.
You're back in with America Outdoors Radio. I'm John Cruz, and we've got a very special guest for you today. It's John Snow. He's the shooting editor for Outdoor Life magazine, and he got really, really lucky lately. He drew a tag for a once-in-a-lifetime moose hunt in Utah. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, John, you were at the Western Hunting and Conservation Expo last year, and you were putting in for non-resident big game tags that are raffled off there, and you got super-duper lucky, and you got the golden ticket, literally, a Shiras moose hunt. Why don't you tell our listeners, first off, what is a Shiras moose?
Yeah, so the Shiras moose is the type of moose that is native anywhere out west. It's a different deal than like a Maine moose or a moose out there. But if you go anywhere in the Intermountain West and you see a moose, it's a Shiras moose. And typically, they are somewhat smaller bodied. They have somewhat smaller antlers, you know, than those big Yukon moose. And one of the telltale signs is that their coat tends to be a really rich, dark black color, which is really kind of cool.
Yes, indeed. Now, this wasn't the first moose tag you've drawn. You live in Montana, and you drew one up there, and you did a do-it-yourself public land hunt. Didn't tag out on a bull, but you did tag it on a cow. This time around, you got the tag for Utah, and I understand you were immediately inundated with all sorts of calls and texts from guides wanting to take you out on very expensive hunts.
Exactly. I mean, these experiences between the two hunts, the tag that I was very fortunate to draw in Montana, and then this, you know, just really outsized good piece of luck to draw this one in Utah, sort of had different outcomes. You know, when I drew the one in Montana, I was just jumping up and down myself. But with the Utah one, the draw results are watched so closely by everybody that, in fact, you know, I found out by people contacting me. It's not like I looked at the draw results and realize what happened. And among the people who were contacting me were, you know, guides and outfitters hoping to get me as a client.
And you ended up booking a guide for this trip. Why'd you make that decision to do so?
The area that this was for is the Wasatch Unit down in Utah, and that's about a 7 or 8 hour pull from my home. And I just kind of knew that with only one chance in my life to do this, that I wanted to do it right, have a reasonable chance of success, and I just knew that there was no way I was going to be able to really scout and properly do this hunt on my own. So, you know, I've been hunting around the West and around the world long enough to kind of sort of size up and come to that determination after I got the tag.
Let's talk about this hunt, because it was very, very different than your typical DIY public land hunt. What you did in Montana is kind of what I envision most people doing for any sort of trophy big game hunt. You went out, you set up camp, you spent a lot of time glassing, you spent a lot of time tromping around, looking for sign, looking for game. Eventually, you know, you found one, and eventually you shot one. That's not at all what happened in terms of your experience here. Why don't you walk us through exactly how the hunt transpired? It started with a phone call or a text, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. I mean, prior to the opener of the hunt, which I think was September 15th, if I recall correctly, and it was a month-long season up there in Utah, you know, I kind of carved out basically all of that time to be available because I knew that the guys I was going with, you know, they were going to have a sort of a group of guides and scouts who were going to be guiding hunters on early elk hunts and other hunts. And, you know, there was a chance if they saw a moose during that time that I could get the call and they would be like, hey, we got a good one spotted or whatever, and can you get on down here? And so that's kind of what I was waiting for. And in fact, a couple days before I was scheduled to start, you know, we had sort of fixed a dates in early October to go down. Regardless, you know, I did get that call that they had seen some moose and could I get down there? And that's exactly what I did. I loaded up the truck. I had my gear ready to go. And my buddy, Bill Buckley, who came along to photograph the hunt, was here in town. And he and I convoyed down there.
You get to literally the coordinates that are texted to you. You meet your guide. What happens next?
Yeah, we got this coordinates on this, basically a dirt two track on public ground. And we ended up meeting Johnny Kellogg, my guide, really nice young guy. And Bill and I had just been in the truck for 7 hours. You know, we had hour and a half left of shooting light. And he's like, you might as well get into your hunting clothes and let's go take a look at this. And so that's what we did. We changed our clothes right there, jumped back in the rigs and we quickly shifted from commuting to hunting and, you know, drove up to this promontory where he had been glassing. And, you know, we got our spotters out and binos out, and didn't take us very long before we spotted these moose. It was a bull and a cow together. So they were kind of paired up, this being sort of at the tail end of their rut.
I know I'm spoiling the story for everyone's going to read this in Outdoor Life, but what happens next?
Well, what happened next was, you know, I made a quick determination. You know, I looked at the moose and saw he was a nice one. And I just sort of, you know, was going through my head. I had booked several days, 5 or 6 days of hunting with this guy. This was a Friday afternoon on public ground. And there were other hunting seasons that were open. And part of what went through my head is I've hunted moose a fair bit over my career, you know, in Canada and Alaska and in Montana as well. So I kind of knew how moose can be here today and gone tomorrow. You know, you don't look a gift bull in the mouth.
Gotcha.
But I did ask, I'm like, have you seen any other bigger animals? And, you know, I pressed Johnny, my guide, on this, and he said, in fact, yes, he had. And I said, well, should we hold out maybe for that one? And he said, no, we can't, because his outfit had contracted with another client who had spent $25,000 for his son.
Wow.
To do a moose hunt there. And he's like, if we went after that moose and shot it, I'd lose my job. So
you got outbid.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. So you make the decision to go after the moose you've got in your sights.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, these moose were probably, you know, 1,200 yards from us, and which is a pretty good chunk of ground to cover. So we hopped in our rigs, drove a little bit, and then started hiking, you know, up and down these sort of aspen ridges and pine ridges to sort of get into a position and see if we can pick them up again. And, you know, so that's what we did. We, you know, hiked for about 40 minutes and you know, got into position and started glassing. And after a while, we managed to get eyes on a creature tucked in the dark timber. And it turned out to be that was the cow. And then not long after that, we saw the bull. And Johnny started doing his moose calls, which calling moose is always really fun. And, you know, somehow was able to peel that bull away from the cow. And he started coming at us. And I got set up. And to make a short story long, I got a good crack at this bull. He was about to come into our laps. And I shot him at the bottom of this draw. And that was my hunt.
So from the time you got the call in Montana to the time this animal was down, what was the total time from Montana to Utah to Hunover?
Well, heck, you know, it was less than a day, you know, and yeah, I mean, it was over quickly, you know. So I spent a lot of time thinking about that because this was a very different hunt. It wasn't sort of the romantic hunt I would have imagined or kind of would have wanted.
Right.
But on the other hand, I don't regret it at all because we went, you know, back out to that area the next day and it was just crawling with people. You know, this place was, you know, within close distance to, you know, just outside of Heber City and sort of that Salt Lake area, and just so many hunters and recreationists. I mean, there were people just spilling all over the place during that weekend. In fact, I even watched a trio of hunters. They were probably deer hunters in blaze orange walking down the very ridge where my moose were. And, you know, I just knew that those animals wouldn't have stayed put there. So it could have been a real disastrous decision to not make that call.
Well, there you go, folks. A successful moose hunt in Utah, but a very, very different sort of public lands hunt. If you want to read more about it, check out the latest edition of Outdoor Life magazine. There's some great photos in there, too. Definitely a story worth reading and something to chew on as you go ahead and think about how our hunting experience is changing here in the Western United States. John, congratulations, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you on America Outdoors Radio.
Oh, thank you so much, John. I really appreciate it. Anytime you want, give me a call.
Hunting and fishing are exercises in hope. Before you head into the woods, you hope to tag out on a deer you'll have to field dress. Before you make that first cast, you hope for a big fish to clean and fillet. When your hopes are realized, you'll need a sharp knife. Whether you sharpen that blade on a power sharpener in the shop or a manual sharpener in the field, WorkSharp has the tool for you. Look for WorkSharp products in sporting goods stores near you or online at WorkSharpTools.com.
Our American spirit is alive and strong, and while we're all going through these unprecedented historical times, we can face these challenges together. Hello, I'm Mark Hemstreet, owner of Shiloh Inns. Although we may wear face masks and practice social distancing, there are no restrictions on making travel memories for business or pleasure. Taking care of our Shiloh guests and employees is the very essence of what we do. At Shiloh Inns, we're open and ready to welcome you to a clean, safe home away from home. You'll find extra cleaning and sanitizing protocols in place for the safety of our guests and employees. At Shiloh Inns, we offer many free amenities like free Wi-Fi and even the kids stay free. So book your next stay with confidence at ShilohInns.com or call 1-800-222-2244. Shiloh Inns, affordable excellence. American family owned and proud of it.
Attention homeowners, spending more time around your house means you're putting more stress on major appliances that keep your home running. Like many Americans, a major breakdown could be very costly during these uncertain times. AC unit goes, that's $4,500. Water heater breaks, $1,500. When you own a home, it's always something. If you have a home warranty, those repairs could cost you nothing. A Home Service Club warranty pays for the repair or replacement of your home appliances and systems when they break down, even from normal wear and tear. For about $1 a day, you can cover your home appliances and systems. It's not a question of if they'll break down, it's when. If you call now, you'll get your first month free and $75 off your first year. Make home appliance repairs one less thing to worry about. Call 800-259-1604 now for your free quote, free first month, and $75 off your first year. 800-259-1604 now. That's 800-259-1604. Again, 800-259-1604.
Immerse yourself in a complete Alaska wilderness experience through Sportsman's Cove Lodge. Up to six of you will spend a week in a beautiful waterfront log home in a secluded cove. Every day is a new adventure. Go on a guided fishing trip or haul in a bounty of shrimp and crab. Visit a Native American village where totem poles are carved. Go on a whale or bear watching trip and return back to your very own place at the end of the day. Find out more about the Alaska Wilderness Experience at alaskasbestlodge.com. That's alaskasbestlodge.com.
Backcountry Hunters and Anglers seeks to ensure North America's outdoor heritage of hunting and fishing. Lend your voice to the fight by visiting backcountryhunters.org and join the 25,000 men and women who have pledged to defend wildlife and public access.
Welcome back to America Outdoors Radio. I'm John Cruz. Time to visit with Larry Captain Mac McQuarrie, the owner of Sportsman's Cove Lodge on Prince of Wales Island in southeast Alaska. Captain Mac, I understand you're actually on a boat right now between Juneau, Alaska and Ocean Shores, Washington.
That's right. That's right. It's been a long trip, 1,200 miles total, and we've got 1,000 of it down and 200 to go.
Glad you're almost back in your home port. Let's talk a little bit about the season that was. COVID-19 threw pretty much an unhittable curveball at a lot of Alaska Lodge operations. It certainly affected yours as well. How did it affect your operation this year?
It was brutal, John. It was brutal. It pretty much wiped us out. We tried a limited operation based on all of the testing protocols and the mandates from the state and what have you. And in spite of rigidly following all of the protocols and the mandates, we ended up with the COVID very early in the season. I ended up getting it along with my wife and my deckhand, and that was the end of the season. It was basically one trip, and so we had to shut down for the rest of the season. It was tough. It was very, very tough.
That is, like you said, brutal. But the good news is testing and getting to Alaska has gotten a lot easier now, and I have no doubt that people are going to be wanting to go back next year. Let's talk about how easy it'll be to get to Alaska this coming year compared to how it was at the beginning where you essentially had to quarantine for 14 days.
Yeah, and we've learned a lot. But this past season was also, there was a lot of indecision this last season. We didn't know, you know, from one week to the next what new mandate might come out, how things might change. But there's a lot going on right now in the terms of therapeutics and maybe even a vaccine. But we learned a lot from this last season. And there are new testing options that we will put into place if we have to. If we're still dealing with the COVID next season, we know how to do it now. We've got it down. For instance, one of the things that we would be doing is self-testing kits that we send to the guests. They would do a self-test at home. It's painless. It's simple. If we're still having to follow the 72-hour rule, that means you have to have a negative test within 72 hours of travel. We can do that easily with these tests. You get the results back within 36 hours of your travel. You get verification of the test. You just hand them to the checkers as you get off the airplane, and you're good to go. So if we're still facing COVID stuff, that's probably what we'll do. That'll meet all the requirements, and it's easy self-test and simple to do. It'll cost about an extra $140-$150, but we're not seeing any resistance to that at all from the guests we're talking to right now. They are chomping at the bit and ready to go.
Well, something else that you offer that just about nobody else does that I'm aware of up in Alaska is the Alaska Wilderness Experience. Now, a lot of folks, whether they be family groups or just close friends, they want to go and have that Alaska experience, but they don't want to be necessarily mingling with other people because they're scared of COVID. So why don't you tell our listeners exactly what the Alaska Wilderness Experience is? It's really a self-contained experience.
It really is. It's in a separate, we call it kind of a satellite facility, away from the lodge, but not that far away from it, a quarter of a mile away from the lodge. And it's set up totally separate from the main lodge. And we had trips this year set up for the AWE package, AWE, the Alaska Wilderness Experience package, that had to be canceled. And it was heartbreaking because there was kids involved and it had been, you know, whole families that had been planning on it and were all excited about it. And then we had to jerk the rug out from underneath them. It was heartbreaking. But yes, it is separate from the entire rest of the facility. And it's not totally fishing. It's more the Alaska experience, as the name implies. It's, you know, crabbing, some fishing, shrimping, bear watching, maybe totem poles. There's a local village close to us, if it's open up, that is great to, for especially for young people to see the native heritage displayed there. Just so many other options other than fishing. There is some fishing. There'll be at least a day of fishing, and you can select from a menu of activities. It's a week-long trip, so you can customize the trip to whatever your interests and your family's interests are or your group's interests. So, yeah, it was tough to have to cancel that, those trips this year.
And again, folks, you basically have your own waterfront lodge with a huge dock that sits in this cove not far from Sportsman's Cove Lodge. I mean, it's your own vacation. It's your own place. You do what you want in terms of the experience, just like Captain Max said. Definitely worth looking into. Running out of time, but hopefully we're getting back to normal next year, and folks are going to be doing the wonderful 4 fishing day trips and 3 fishing day trips you offer out of the main lodge. And folks, if you want to experience great fishing in Alaska and off-the-charts customer service and fantastic food, you've got to check out Sportsman's Cove Lodge. The website to do so is alaskasbestlodge.com. That's alaskasbestlodge.com. And you're going to want to book now because Mac has got this huge customer base that didn't get to go this past year, and they want to go next year. They're signing up, so space is limited. We've got to go, but anything else you want to say before we do, Captain Mac?
Just to reiterate, the space is limited because about 70% of our guests from last year that we had to cancel have rolled over into this year. So we only have 30% of our inventory left to sell to be sold out, and it's going to go fast. So get on it, folks, and we'd love to see you.
That's alaskasbestlodge.com for Sportsman's Cove Lodge. Hop on there, check out the Alaska Wilderness Experience, check out the great opportunities they have for fishing at the main lodge, and head on up there. You are going to love it. Captain Max, stay healthy. Give my best to your wife, Patty, and I look forward to chatting with you again soon.
Great, John. Thank you very much.
Hunting season's here, and that's why this is a great time to talk about WorkSharp, because they've got manual knife sharpeners, ones that'll fit in your pocket, that'll fit in your glove box, that'll fit in your pack. And if you're out hunting, you're going to need a sharp knife, especially when you get that animal down and it's time to skin it, it's time to quarter it. You've got to have a sharp knife. Try doing that with a dull knife, and you'll be there all day and all night. So make sure that you've got a manual knife sharpener from WorkSharp with you. And the place to get it is just about any quality hardware or sporting goods store in the United States, or you can get it online. You can do that by going to WorkSharpTools.com, and when you check out, be sure to use the coupon code RADIO, because when you type that in, you will instantly get 30% off your entire order, plus free shipping. Now that is a deal at WorkSharpTools.com. Our last news item of the day is about acorns. They make up a significant part of the diet for many animals in the fall, and in Ohio, the Department of Natural Resources actually surveys the oak trees they have in 38 wildlife areas to determine how many of them are bearing fruit. This year, 70% of the red oak trees surveyed in Ohio bore fruit, well above the long-term average, but only 27% of white oaks did, which is below average. According to the Ohio DNR, wildlife prefer white oaks because red oak acorns contain a high amount of tannin and they taste bitter. White-tailed deer, wild turkeys, and squirrels concentrate near areas with heavy crops of white and chestnut oak acorns. Acorns are an important food source for many species. Numerous studies have linked the abundance of acorns to body conditions, winter survival, and reproductive success of white-tailed deer, wild turkeys, black bears, gray squirrels, and ruffed grouse. Furthermore, hunters can use this information to key in on areas to improve hunting success. So there you go. All sorts of information about oak trees and acorns you probably never knew before that just might get you thinking and looking for game the next time you see some acorns on the ground. We've got to wrap things up today, but I hope you have enjoyed our guests as much as I have. Great information from each and every one of them. I also hope you're getting outside this October. Myself, I am going duck hunting this weekend. Others of you are out there pheasant hunting, still others are deer hunting, and a few of you are out fishing too, and it's a wonderful time of year to do that as well. If you didn't catch our entire show, you can always catch it as a podcast. We're on just about all the platforms you can think of. Just look for America Outdoors Radio and you'll find us in a hurry. And be sure to check out our website too at AmericaOutdoorsRadio.com, where you can find links to our sponsor pages and get a preview of what's coming up on next week's show. Last but not least, don't forget to like and follow our America Outdoors Radio Facebook page, because we are always doing giveaways, and I've got a feeling another one is coming up very soon. Here's hoping you are blessed during this wonderful month of October. Here's hoping you stay healthy too. And here's hoping you get to spend some time in nature. After all, it is your country and you're outdoors, so get out there and enjoy it.